KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Bayview, Hunters Point.
Hayward.
Piedmont, California.
Pleasanton.
Fall Town.
Richmond.
Sunset.
Oakland, California.
Concord, California.
Fairfield.
Foothill.
Coming up, we're going to hop on a bus with some Bay Area lawyers driving around helping people become citizens.
You have to really gain their trust, and that's difficult to do in the scope of a few hours.
Then we'll learn about the radical history of South Asians in the Bay Area.
For over 100 years, people who look like me, people who speak my language, they've been walking these streets.
And we'll meet a San Francisco graffiti artist who's using clothing as his canvas.
We're shopping at Trader Joe's, and some guy was wearing this Daly City shirt I designed. I said, hey, I designed that shirt.
Wearable art from around the Bay Area, coming up on Cross Currents. Across the country, legal residents wanting citizenship are waiting twice as long as they were 2 years ago for their applications to be processed. That's creating a backlog at a time when immigrants are increasingly nervous about their status. And in California, there just aren't enough affordable attorneys to help. KALW's Teresa Katsourilis joins one group of Bay Area lawyers trying to bridge that gap.
So I want to start first by getting the chance to get to know who's on the bus with us today. So maybe a quick show of hands for folks who have been on the Justice Bus before.
Jess Temple is kneeling on a sticky bus seat with a clipboard of papers. About 24 attorneys are staring back at her, quietly eating free granola bars and Valentine's Day candy.
Everybody else, welcome to your first Justice Bus. We like to kick stuff off with an icebreaker.
Jess is a staff attorney at One Justice, a nonprofit working to bring legal services to communities that need them. The Justice Bus is one of its most popular programs.
How many full-time legal aid lawyers do we think there are in the state of California? It's about 800. It's about one for every 16,250 Californians in need.
This legal desert gets even worse in rural communities. So One Justice came up with a novel solution. Recruit corporate attorneys from San Francisco's top law firms and tech companies, give them a crash course in immigration law, then stick them on a bus. Right now, we're lurching through traffic armed with color-coded packets.
Okay. So now what I'd love to do is grab our checklist that we have for naturalization from our blue folders.
This is phenomenally different from what I'm usually doing. This is nothing similar.
First-timer Justin Fish is sitting in the back of the bus by the window. He's an associate at Morrison & Forrester, a large corporate law firm, and this trip is personal for him.
I am an immigrant myself. I was 11 years old.
For him, becoming a citizen was easy. Justin's Canadian, his father's an American citizen. His clients today won't be that lucky, and Justin will only have a few hours to help them.
You have to really, as a representative, you know, gain their trust and imbue confidence that they should trust you with their story. They should trust you with what you're going to write down on that form. And that's difficult to do in the scope of a few hours.
The I-5 highway's green hills give way to Harley-Davidson dealerships as the Justice Bus arrives in Stockton.
All right, so we're just going to do a quick head count, Bismarck, before we get going.
Today, the attorneys are partnering with El Concilio, a nonprofit that provides legal aid and community programs in Stockton.
Take a seat, and probably in about 10 to 15, we'll start to let you know what your pairs are going to be, and folks can start to get organized around their tables as well.
Then the clients start filing in. It's a dark and rainy afternoon, but the waiting room is packed with nearly 30 people, more than expected. Most are Latino and have been legal residents for years. One family shows up with their 80-year-old mother and gently parks her wheelchair next to the nearest attorney. Several parents show up after work with their kids, who start patiently drawing cartoons on extra Know Your Rights worksheets.
Can I ask what you drew?
Oh, that's really cool. Who is that?
I don't know. I just drew someone.
Okay. She looks cool.
Sergio Reles is here with his wife. Like many people here, it took him and his One Justice lawyer about 3 hours to go through the paperwork.
Entonces no es difícil, pero
The application used to be about 10 pages long. Now it's over 20, a change that happened during the Obama administration. The questions get pretty strange. Are you a polygamist? Have you ever committed genocide? Sergio was asked about every time he's left the country since he moved to the U.S., and he moved to the U.S. a while ago.
¿Cuántos años atrás?
Desde que entré a Estados Unidos.
¿Y cuándo?
Son 33 años.
33 años.
33 years. Then there are the application fees, more than $700. Sergio says he wants to become a citizen so that he can vote in the next election. He'll also feel safer.
Si no nos hacemos ciudadanos, nos pueden mandar para nuestro país.
If we don't become citizens, he says, President Trump could send us back. There are very drastic changes happening in this country. Attorney Nelson Ibarra is overseeing today's legal clinic. According to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, applications have gone up since Trump took office. To Nelson, it's pretty clear why.
They're either being led by fear because of the current administration, and honestly, immigration is getting tougher.
Last fall, one justice sued the Trump administration over a growing backlog in citizenship applications. They claim immigration is allocating fewer resources, scrutinizing more applications, and denying citizenship to more people. Some advocates have even started referring to the naturalization process as a second wall.
And I would go even further and say something as akin to like a spiked wall, because it's not just that potentially a person can be denied their citizenship, right? If they make a mistake, they're not only going to be denied, but they're going to be taken away to their home country.
Justin Fish, the attorney who's riding the justice bus for the first time, he didn't have to go through any of this when he immigrated to the U.S. from Canada as a kid. By the time the last client leaves, Justin and his fellow attorneys have been working all day. So they're celebrating.
Can I ask you what you're doing right now?
Drinking wine.
The lawyers traipse back to the bus, exhausted but happy. Some of the attorneys start to nod off, but Justin's thinking about his mom, who's lived in the U.S. as a legal resident for years without becoming a citizen.
I think that our immigration system as a whole is just so convoluted and so difficult to navigate that, you know, a lot of people just don't want to give it a go, and you can't blame them.
Now there's a sense of urgency. Justin mentions one of today's clients, a middle-aged man who's a legal resident, but...
The last time he came back into the country, he was detained for hours at the airport in Sacramento and had just gone to visit, you know, some family in Mexico, just like I'd visit my family in Canada. And I think that awakened him to the idea that his he really needed to focus on making sure he had the strongest rights possible. But fear is a big driver, and I think that really hit home today.
Justin says the experience energized him. He's getting ready to volunteer again. I'm Teresa Cotsarillas for Cross Currents.
Teresa is KALW's immigration reporter. Get in touch with her at immigration@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. There are thousands of hidden histories in the Bay Area and a handful of guided walking tours that get beneath the surface of what we see when we go about our daily lives. Architecture tours, neighborhood tours. And then there's the Berkeley South Asian Radical Walking Tour. The tour began in 2012, and it traces the history of politically active South Asians in and around Berkeley going back over 100 years. Reporter Sandhya Dirks took the tour a few years back and reported this story.
It can get pretty loud, so come closer, and this is a good time to practice coming closer.
Bernali Ghosh is trying to corral about 15 people on a drizzly December afternoon. The walking tour is basically the love child of her and her husband, Arnavan Chatterjee. Before we begin, a little bit of cultural translation. I'll let Chatterjee do the honors.
When I say South Asia, I'm referring to
India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Bhutan, the Maldives. The other word I'm going to be using sometimes is Desi, D-E-S-I, which is a colloquial term that many South Asians, especially in diaspora, use to refer to themselves.
The group of, yes, mostly, but not all Desis, meets outside a community center on Berkeley's Telegraph Ave. Chatterjee climbs up to a perch on the porch steps and gets going.
So we're going to start with the story of one of my big Desi role models, Ali Ishtiak. And here is a photo of Ali.
Chatterjee pulls the photo from a giant binder he's carrying. You quickly learn this walking tour has a lot of props. But from the beginning, it's the guide's intimacy with the subject matter that stands out.
Everybody in his life pretty much calls him Tinku, which is a silly-sounding nickname, but it's his.
Tinku's story starts out in typical fashion. A bright Bangladeshi student comes to America, goes to college in the 80s, gets an engineering degree. But Tinku's narrative is a bit different because he's gay. And although he has a partner, Scott, he longs for some connection to his South Asian roots. And he finds it in two friends he meets here.
And all three of them are South Asian techies because stereotypes are real sometimes. For Tinku, it's amazing. Meeting two other queer South Asian men and be able to suddenly, for the first time, be able to like share so many stories that he's never been able to share with anybody else before.
The two men he met founded Chikon, the first queer group specifically meant for South Asians. Our guides take us even further back in time, back to some of the earliest South Asian radicals here.
So, the name of the young student whose story we're going to hear, his name is Kartar Singh Sarabha. And I want you to say that with me. Kartar Singh Sarabha. One more time with feeling.
Kartar Singh Sarabha.
In 1912, Sarabha was a 15-year-old Punjabi student who came to study chemistry at Berkeley. Moved to activism by his treatment as a second-class human, Sarabha helped found the Ghadar Party, a group of Punjabis in the U.S. and Canada who organized to gain India's independence. He was also a poet. Here is Chatterjee playing the part of Sarabha.
If anyone asks who we are, tell him our name is Rebel. Our duty is to end the tyranny. Our profession is to launch revolution. That is our namaz. This is our sandhya, our puja.
You might have noticed my name, sandhya, being said there. In Sanskrit, it means twilight, the meeting of two lights. It's also a prayer. My own Desi identity is why I wanted to come on this tour. And I find myself learning things I didn't know, like about the activist poet Sarabha, how he returned home from Berkeley to fight for Indian independence, how at 19 he was hanged by the British government. After this story, the group pauses for a second. The sky is growing dark. It is the sandhya time. The tour's final destination is Berkeley High School, where we come crashing back to the not-so-distant past, 9/11 and its aftermath. Tour guide Chatterjee tells the story of South Asian students newly arrived at the high school.
Everything falls apart for them. I mean, as they walk through the halls, they're all called names like terrorist.
Chatterjee says one girl was beaten so badly, she went to the hospital. After that, he says the students responded by going from classroom to classroom, telling stories.
Deeper stories, more personal stories.
Stories that actually changed the mood at the school. At the end of the tour, Chatterjee and Ghosh asked the group to share the story that moved them the most. And it's kind of amazing. Everyone gets up and people's reactions are really raw. Priya Aslam's favorite story, the last one. She was a newly arrived college student in Iowa when 9/11 happened.
And I remember being really scared, really alone, far away from my family in Pakistan. The story is very similar to my story and how we educated people about where Pakistan was and who we really were and what Islam actually preaches.
For people like Aslam, the tour feels really personal. It's personal for the tour's founders too. As an immigrant from Bangladesh, Ghosh felt between worlds, but when she and Chatterjee began to uncover the century-old radical history of South Asians, it gave her a sense that people like her had been here all along. The journey was a bit shorter for her husband.
For me, growing up in the East Bay suburbs, it felt like my heritage was all about being that perfect model minority. Sure, that's important. I'm a computer programmer by trade, and I actually like it. But the more Bernali and I have learned these stories, the more we've discovered these, I mean, I think it shows me that I have a very different kind of heritage, because for over 100 years, people who look like me, people who speak my language, they've been walking these streets, and they have been working for justice.
Now, Chatterjee and Ghosh walk these streets to tell stories. Stories to bind us to the past, and stories that give those who live in many worlds a reason to call this one home. In Berkeley, I'm Sandhya Dirks for Cross Currents.
That story first aired in 2015. The next Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour takes place March 24th. Find the information at kelw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In the Bay Area's independent clothing market, it's not uncommon for the worlds of fashion and art to intersect. Local brands like Upper Playground, Oaklandish, and True have all gone on to build national customer followings, with many of the graphics on the clothes being designed by local graffiti and street artists. One of those artists who's made the transition from the spray can to garments is San Francisco's Nathan Tan. He got into the local graffiti scene back in the 80s, and after starting out of his Sunset District garage, today clothes from Nate's company New School can be found in boutiques across the city and even as far as Japan and Ireland. He stopped by KALW to share his story.
1987 is like so many years ago, and for the West Coast history with graffiti, those are like the early dinosaur years where it just, East Coast hip-hop just touched down here in the Bay Area. And with the commercialism of hip-hop, we were able to see the blueprint that New York created and give it our own West Coast twist. I started writing in a crew called the Masterpiece Creators. And it was a Chicago-based crew that was given to us by originators from Chicago, namely Orko from the Feds crew. So we felt really lucky to be able to continue that legacy. So it was Omen 2 and I, mainly, who ran the crew from 1987 till the present. I was putting a lot of time into it right off the bat. I mean, I started dabbling with it before 87, but 87 was the year that I quote to people, because that's the year I actually started applying spray paint to the wall in an artistic way. So after 87, it was pretty much over. It's everything I spent my time doing. Everything else was secondary, you know, including my homework and chores. And I just wanted to practice and get better and better, because San Francisco had so many amazing, talented, teenage, young kids that were involved in this. And just being accepted into that culture, I knew I had to represent, and I wanted to be good. And my mentor as well, Omen 2, had already been writing for like 3 or 4 years. So I'm like running with a legend. To me, a smart person looks at history and uses it to lead their own life. So by 1987, so much of the blueprint for hip hop as a business, as a career path even, had already been done in New York by all the amazing pioneers like FaZe and Scene and Doze and etc. So not that I got into graffiti or hip hop as a means to have a career, but because I'm passionate about what I do, I knew once it became more than just a hobby, like how to utilize it in my life. Although years and years later, I actually worked in the corporate fashion industry in the Bay Area as a designer, as a graphic designer. But years before that, in the early 90s, Omen and I actually opened an airbrush shop not too far from here on 3rd Street. And it was one of the first airbrush stores where you can go and get an airbrush jacket or overalls at the time, you know, were popular. So I always tell people that that was my start actually getting into fashion, was airbrushing clothes. I worked in the fashion design industry until 2003. And in 2003, my wife was pregnant with our first child, Sean, and we had him, or my wife had him at the hospital. That day when we came home with him, the phone rang, and I saw on the caller ID, it was my corporate job calling me, and I thought, man, they're on it. They're calling me as like within an hour of getting home from the hospital. I thought, this pretty nice. And I pick it up. 30 seconds later, I found out I got canned. They laid off my whole department and I lost my job. So at that time, just bought a house. I just bought a new car, which I'm still driving today. And I was devastated. The whole entrepreneurial spirit in my family, and it was forced upon me. I always freelanced a little bit and, you know, was doing things like that, but I never said, hey, go and make a living hustling, really. So it forced me out there, and that was what made me start freelancing, which made me start Nate One Design graphics, logo company. And I was able to make ends meet while starting New School. Eventually, I wanted to use my children's industry experience. I designed for some children's companies. So I said, okay, that's one thing that differentiates my design experience. So I remember talking to my wife, and we're trying to come up with a name, and she was like, well, what's the name for the next generation? And couple of whack ideas, and then finally I said New School, and she was like, that's it. And I was like, better listen to her more. You know, and so of course I spelled it in a hip-hop fashion by spelling it S-K-O-O-L, and that was it. What hip-hop, of course, including graffiti, writing, culture, taught me was to be self-sufficient. Make do with what you have. Don't go outside of that box if it's not necessary. You have everything you need already. We're really lucky here in the Bay Area that small businesses, almost no matter what you're doing, there's a market, or there's an audience, or there's a customer out there that if you really focus and hone in what you're doing, you can make a living, or you can have a great side hustle. Real like inner turmoil is like when you're an artist and you're making your artwork commercial or commercially accessible. That's the hardest thing. People always talk about keeping it real or being true to your stuff, and that's the really tough one, you know, to know how to do that but still have integrity. And if you have integrity with your work and you can make a living from it, that is a blessing.
That was San Francisco artist and clothing designer Nathan Tan. We have more about him at klw.org. That piece was produced by Bo Walsh. And don't forget, subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. Listen to all our stories anytime, whenever you want, wherever you want. Go to klw.org and click Cross Currents.
This music is by Oniko from Oakland. She's performing tomorrow at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco. Misery loves the symphony.
Does your face, your pretty face, does it get lost in a crowd? And you say no one's there to hear you cry out loud. What will you do, Susie Blue? What will you do, Susie Blue?
Today's team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Eli Wortschafter, and Aaliyah Renee Yates. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Secret.